This is Circe Olson Wessner, and I'm the director of the Museum of the American Military Family, and this is our podcast, At Ease. Our museum is located in Tijeras, New Mexico, and it has collected hundreds of interviews and stories over the years, many of which can be found here at MAMF Media and also on one of our many blogs. I'm really excited today to be speaking with my cousin, Kevin Olson, who is a playwright, he's a director, and a professor. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Circe. It's great to be here.
Well, I wanted to tell our listeners that we're talking by phone because we are distanced away from each other. You're on the East Coast, and we're out here in New Mexico. And so I just am so excited to be able to talk to you today. Two other things I didn't mention is you're the founder of a company called Firsthand Theatrical, which creates and presents productions using primary source material. And you're also a pastor's kid. So let's talk a little bit about that first. Let's talk about your childhood for a few minutes. Your dad was a pastor for about 50 years. What denomination were you raised in? What was your childhood like?
Well, at the time that I was a child, my father was ordained in the Dutch Reformed Church. And I happened to be born in his final year, just as he was finishing seminary in Holland, Michigan. Mm-hmm. And very quickly, he accepted a parish in Woodstock, New York, of all places, which was his first church. And from there, we moved down to an urban parish in Jamaica, Queens, in New York City, where he was for several years during the 1960s. And that's the church that I was a little kid in. Mm-hmm. And I have many memories of going to services there. There was beautiful music in that church, and that's something I think that even as you know what you know about my father, and certainly your father, mm-hmm. music was very important to him mm-hmm. in his ministerial work. From there, we moved to another church in Passaic, New Jersey, and then ultimately to Staten Island. So. I did enjoy going to church. I admired my father greatly, and I certainly enjoyed all the music that was part of the church services.
So did you feel like you had extra pressure put on you to behave a certain way because your dad was a pastor, or were you just allowed to be?
In hindsight, I would say, well, of course I did, but... Mm-hmm. I don't remember feeling that at all. I knew that I was the oldest, and I suppose there's in our family of four children, and I suppose that somewhat intuitively I felt somewhat under the microscope, but, you know, Circe, I was a really good kid. I was well-behaved. I was interested in people, and people generally liked me. So I think, I don't mean to brag or anything,
right,
but I certainly don't recall ever being self-conscious of that pressure. But, of course, in hindsight, given the circumstances that I just mentioned, I can say, sure, I probably did. If I didn't feel pressure, I certainly felt a little bit under the spotlight.
Well, you know, a lot of military kids grow up knowing that they are childhood ambassadors when they go overseas, representing not only the branch of service their parents are in, they're representing their family, they're representing the entire United States of America, and there's this huge pressure. And then also, the military does have a tendency to punish the sponsor, the service member, if the family misbehaves. So that's why I was kind of asking, because many military kids and kids growing up on military installations feel this enormous pressure to behave because it can reflect on their families. And so speaking of that, I don't have many childhood memories of us because I was living overseas and you were in the States, but I remember visiting your house in Jamaica, I think. It seemed very country. There was like a porch, a screened porch, but that may not have been Jamaica. That might have been somewhere else.
No, there was a screened porch. You have a very good memory.
That's one of the only things I can remember, and then an apartment in New York City.
I don't remember your visit to our apartment. I do remember the visit to Jamaica, but that's just the fault of my memory. We did live in an apartment in Manhattan on the Upper West Side. My father left the Dutch Reformed Church and had enrolled in a doctoral program at Teachers College at Columbia University, where my mom coincidentally also worked. And so when he left the Dutch Reformed Church, he actually demitted. He enrolled in this doctoral program, and we moved to the Upper West Side to be near where my mom worked and where he was attending classes.
So many of our listeners are military brats, and they've moved a lot. Our family is a military family, moved 18 times, and many of our listeners can relate to your childhood of moving from parish to parish. Was it hard for you to move from place to place, or did you adapt easily? What were some of your thoughts on that?
Again, you know, thinking back on it, I would say that I never really felt that I struggled with the moving from place to place. Of course, I changed schools a fair amount in those years, and that may have been the most difficult adjustment. But interestingly, I did something sort of crazy. When we lived in New Jersey, I started at a prep school in Montclair, New Jersey. And when my father left that parish to move to Staten Island, New York for a parish there, I stayed enrolled at the prep school in Montclair, New Jersey, and sometimes spent weeks at the very generous offer of a home of a good friend of mine during my junior and senior high school years. And I actually ended up commuting for a couple years from Staten Island, and then when we moved to Manhattan, I commuted from Manhattan. And I don't recall ever feeling particularly troubled by that, as insane as it may sound to your listeners. It certainly was, in hindsight, a crazy thing not only for me to do, but for my parents to allow me to do. But I really loved this school, and I was doing very well there, and I subsequently learned I was on a full scholarship there. So that made a big difference, and of course I got a fabulous education. So in hindsight, it was the commuting to junior and senior high school that was probably the biggest struggle for me in terms of moving from place to place.
So, well, it's obvious that you really were driven. You were driven to finish school there, and you went above and beyond to get to graduate from there. Did you have a lot of extracurriculars there in theater or music in your prep school? And also, what was your major when you went to college?
I was in the Glee Club. I was in a sort of a subgroup called the Master Singers, and I was in several plays in high school, which should not surprise you or anyone who knows my life at all reasonably well. I loved it, and when I did graduate from high school, I actually took some time off and didn't enroll in college right away. Actually, that's not entirely true, because I did enroll at Columbia, but that was not a good place for me to be. So I did end up taking some time off and finally did enroll in college at one of the State University of New York campuses in upstate New York, Oneonta, where I was a theater major and a speech major, and really found myself there, I would say, so much so that when I graduated college, I enrolled in a Master of Fine Arts in Directing program at the University of Minnesota.
Well, that's quite a leap.
Very much so.
So I have a question. So where have you finally settled? So where are you now?
As you know, right now we're in Rhode Island, where we've been since 2005. But essentially, after getting my Master's of Fine Arts in Directing, I met Amy, and we ended up getting married. And actually, we spent 1 year teaching, ironically enough, at the college in Holland, Michigan, where my parents went. I was a visiting instructor of theater there for a year. But then we moved back to Minneapolis, and we lived in Minneapolis and St. Paul for over 20 years. until we moved to Rhode Island in 2005, when my wife's parents moved into assisted living, and we felt we wanted to and needed to be back in Rhode Island to be near them. So we've been here living the life in New England for now however many years it is, 15 years, and I don't know if I'm finally settled given sort of my life journeys to living in many places, but there are no plans to go anywhere else at the moment, but I guess you never know.
That is absolutely true. Every time we moved, it's like, let's just stay here, and then about 2 years, 3 years, 10 years in, we start itching to move again. So I just wanted to start veering towards Firsthand Theatrical, which is a company you started. It's your own business. Why did you start Firsthand Theatrical?
Well, I didn't initially set out to start a theater company, but its origins can be found in listening to a sermon, and perhaps the last sermon that my father actually delivered, one October morning, oh, I'm going to say in 2013, and he was guest preaching at a very rural church in Vermont on a beautiful October day, and the church was on a hillside, and I can keep going on and on about how beautiful it was, but the sermon he delivered that day was titled, My Bible, Then and Now. And it was absolutely brilliant. And so we went out to lunch, and I had just come up for the weekend to visit my folks. Amy wasn't with me. And as I was driving back to Rhode Island from Vermont, I thought that there were, you know, only about 20 people were at the service that morning, and I just thought that this sermon deserved to be spread to a wider audience. And so my father passed away a couple of years later, but while he was still alive, I called him up shortly thereafter and said, you know, I have this crazy idea of trying to turn your sermon into a play. And so he and I went back and forth, and we did in fact create a play called Interrupting the Sermon that resulted from that.
And so I wanted to talk about Interrupting the Sermon right now. It on your website, it says that it's based on your dad's sermons and poems, and it mentioned Woodstock and a nuclear rally and the AIDS epidemic. So I want you to talk a little bit more in detail about Interrupting the Sermon, but how did you decide which memories to include in it? Because your dad had 50 years of being a pastor. So you had to pick only a few memories. And then the other question that is burning in my mind, when you mentioned Woodstock, were you there? Did you get to go to the festival?
Well, no. That happened after we had left Woodstock. We moved away from Woodstock in the early 60s to Jamaica, New York. Interestingly, and then I'll get back to interrupting the sermon, my dad also was sometimes a guest chaplain at a resort in upstate New York for a week, and we got to stay there for free, and it became kind of a vacation. And we actually, the place was not far from where the Woodstock Festival was held in 1968, and we got caught in the traffic jam heading to this resort for the festival. So that's my memory of the festival. But in any case, back to the play.
Right.
So again, I worked with my father on kind of picking out the material. And what I tried to do and what he helped me do is to take various sections of this sermon and find both poetry he had written, and we also incorporated some of the stories, the memories he had written in short story form about his career in the ministry. And in looking thematically at different sections of the sermon, we looked for stories that also, and poems that seemed to capture his own theological evolution, and certainly his evolution from a fairly conservatively theological young man growing up in the Midwest to someone who, through his life experiences in urban New York City, started to, I don't really know how to say it, become aware of the world and the variety of challenges that he was facing in his ministry. And so things like him reflecting back on his days in Woodstock, where he was asked to give an invocation by someone named Howard Koch, who was one of the screenwriters of Casablanca, and he refused to give the invocation at this anti-nukes rally because his parishioners would not approve of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so he backed out of doing this, much to his regret. Years later, when he had finished his doctorate and become the director of campus ministry programs in Indianapolis, Indiana, mm-hmm. he founded the AIDS ministry in the city of Indianapolis. And so the story about the AIDS baptism comes from there. But the basic plan was to relate sections of the sermon to some of the life experience he had had, and then I suppose the poems filled a more liturgical element in the play, and actually reflected his growing interest in the transcendentalist philosophies of Henry David Thoreau, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Margaret Fuller, and others.
Mm.
And so it was a very interesting combination of different types of material that I think we did a pretty good job of piecing together in this play.
And I have seen video clips of it. It's really, really good. So after interrupting the sermon, you wrote a piece which my dad and son and I all contributed to. It's called Life Poems in Motion. And it was interesting when you pitched it to us. I was happy to give you a poem, and then I was very skeptical as to how you can bring a poem to life. And so I want you to tell our listeners a little bit about the concept and how one does perform poems.
Well, again, another sort of crazy idea. The play that I did in between was a very text-heavy piece about little-known Jewish stories during the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
And it included some pieces from my wife's father, my brother-in-law's father, and other people that I found out about. And it was okay, but it was incredibly text heavy. And it was, you know, a character standing on stage as, say, Amy's father telling the story of when his best buddy was killed in Germany during the Second World War. And I thought, well, that was okay, but I need to break it up a little bit. I need to, for myself, if I'm going to continue doing this kind of work, find ways to be a bit more theatrical and perhaps even abstract.
Mm-hmm.
So my wife and I were having dinner one evening, having this conversation. My wife has a cousin named Lisa Starr, who at the time was the poet laureate of Rhode Island, and someone who hosted in her bed and breakfast on Block Island a relatively well-known poetry retreat every summer, where well-known poets from around the country would come mm-hmm. sit there and write and create and share. And so we thought, well, you know, maybe we could do something with Lisa's poetry. But then I said, but I want it to be firsthand. I want it to be about people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
And then I remembered some of the poetry my father had written for the earlier play, Interrupting the Sermon. And then I said, well, I know we've got a lot of writers in the family, so let me just put out a blanket call, and you and your father and your son all sent in material. My brother sent in material. I dug out some appropriate poems. And we decided to set that play up as a series of stages of life, but then I thought, what are we going to do with just people reciting poetry? And then I had the totally insane idea to have the poetry almost be like music that people would dance to. And so I know someone locally who's a choreographer, and we auditioned dancers, and we had people read the poems while the dancers were dancing, sometimes a bit more literally, sometimes quite abstractly, to the rhythm, the sounds, the tones of the poems that reflected, if not literally the action of the poem, at least the themes of the poem. And we did that at the Providence Fringe Festival. Oh, what year was that, Circe? I want to say maybe 2015 or 14.
Yeah, it was somewhere around, I was going to say 16, but I don't know. But
it could have been 16, yeah.
But it's kind of interesting because, you know, you said literally. So in my poem, we talk about driving the truck and running over a rabbit, and
right.
and one of your dancers did carry that off quite well. There was a thump, and the dancer was a thump, and it was quite, you know, it was interesting to see, you know, thump, oops, that rabbit's not going to make it.
Yeah.
and the dancer portrayed all of that with obviously minimal, you know, no talking and minimal action, but everybody got it. It was very, very good. So going on, since we can't remember quite on which year that was, between 2017 and now, you've done several other plays based on family history of your collaborator, and I just wanted to ask you to talk about the two plays I'm thinking about, How Many Bushels Am I Worth, and the one right before that. Talk about those.
Yeah, so the last 3 years of what I've been doing stem from this project. There's a woman that I became aware of in Skokie, Illinois, named Benna Shglenoy. And Benna Shglenoy was someone who emigrated to Chicago from the Soviet Union in 1976 as part of the Save Soviet Jewry movement. Now, she had put together a really interesting website of her family history that she spent 11 years putting together. She went to archives in Ukraine and in Moscow and in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv and a couple of other places, gathering what information she could about relatives near and far. And she ended up, this woman, Benna, ended up hiring a cousin of my wife's to help her edit and put this website together. And when there was a draft of the website, this cousin, Deanna, forwarded it to Amy's sister and said, can you look this over? And Amy's sister, Paula, said, well, Kevin's interested in this stuff. Why don't they send it to him? And sort of like calling my father up way back when, out of the blue, I contacted both this editor cousin and Benna and said, I have a crazy idea of trying to turn this into a play. And we created from that the first play, which is called And Then What? And it's the story of her grandmother, who she was very close to, and her grandmother's six siblings. And it was a very tedious process to do that. We performed that play as a stage reading, and it went extremely well. It went extremely well. It was incredibly well received, and we wanted to keep working together. And if you were to print out from her website her family history, it would be a huge stack of papers. And of course, there was a lot more material there to mine.
Mm-hmm.
I was always interested in the Save Soviet Jewry movement, having sort of come of age during that particular time when I was, you know, interested in U.S.-Soviet relationships. And I wanted to tell the story of her emigration. So the first play focused on her grandmother and her siblings going back to the 1870s through the 1970s, covering the lifespans of these siblings. And then this play actually tells this woman's story, my partner's story, from the time she was born in the mid-1940s, right after, as the Soviets called it, the Great Patriotic War, what we call World War II,
mm-hmm.
and through her emigration to Chicago in 1976. And, of course, she's still with us, obviously. So we created that play. We performed both plays at the Piven Theater in Evanston, Illinois, in the summer of 2018. And then just recently, right before Corona, we took the How Many Bushels Am I Worth, the story of her emigration, and performed it here in Providence, and then also down in Brooklyn, New York. And that run ended right at the end of January, and I'm just grateful that we had that time frame, because had we been 1 month later, who knows if we would have actually done it. So it was a tremendously exciting and gratifying effort.
So you keep mentioning Save Soviet Jewry movement. What is that?
So throughout the Stalin era and through Khrushchev and then Brezhnev, you know, Jews in the Soviet Union or Tsarist Russia, as in so many other places, have been so severely discriminated against.
Mm.
And there had always been efforts to try to rescue Jews from Russia, the Soviet mm-hmm. Union, Ukraine, mm-hmm. and all the Soviet republics.
Mm-hmm.
And the Soviet Union underwent a severe food shortage in the mid to late 1960s, more or less. I may not have that
right.
all properly timelined,
yeah.
but they wanted American wheat.
Uh-huh.
And Senator Henry Jackson and Vanek in the House of Representatives also were saying, well, let's use this. Let's leverage a trade deal, which part of that trade deal is that in exchange for American wheat, which the Soviet Union desperately wanted, we want to insist that the Soviet Union start to allow Jews to leave the Soviet Union. And those were the early years of the Save Soviet Jewry movement. And finally, the Soviet Union under Brezhnev at that time started to allow X number of Jews to leave the Soviet Union. And this movement actually continued really up until the early to mid-1990s under various kinds of contexts where once that movement started, American Jews, the American government, others as well from other faith communities mm-hmm. started to rally for Soviet Jewry. And in the course of the movement, there were hundreds of thousands of Jews that were allowed out of the Soviet Union. So the story is full of all kinds of history going back decades to the incredible bureaucracy one had to undertake for this particular emigration out of the Soviet Union, etc. So I don't know if I represented that fully accurately, but that's about as concisely as I can tell that story.
Well, and you did really well not having been told that you were going to be asked that question. I thought that was very brilliant. So I wanted to get back to sort of the process then, because, you know, you've got absolute history, you've got family letters, I'm sure you had photographs, you had this website that has, you know, you said piles of documents if you printed it out. So if you were going to just break down the process really quickly for our listeners, I have this beautiful family letter. What are you going to look at in this letter to decide to put it into a script, and how do you make it into a script instead of just this letter?
I don't know that there's a precise answer to that.
Mm.
I like to take a theme. So the theme would be the Save Soviet Jewry movement. The theme would be the life cycles and dance.
Mm.
The theme would be my father's transformation over the course of his career. And find as much as I can stories that relate to that theme. And then, so this family letter that you mentioned, that could, in fact, be the trigger for a theme, depending on its contents.
Right.
Or I might say, hey, this fits nicely into my theme of whatever that theme might be that I want to explore in this piece. Or I might say, well, you know, it's a beautiful letter, it's an interesting story, but let me set that aside. Maybe somewhere down the road I'll be working on a project where this could be really an effective piece to, in fact, use in a play. I like to use as much as possible
mm-hmm.
Words that people have either spoken or written.
Mm-hmm.
That's not always possible. So in all of my plays, I have sort of sometimes, for the sake of clarity, tweaked some of the words a bit. Sometimes I'll get an idea that we can create an interesting, hopefully interesting theatrical moment. And so I might throw in a transition statement or some kind of phrase that might allow us to create that moment. So I would say my plays are 90% firsthand accounts, mm-hmm. one way or the other.
And so that's why you named your company that, firsthand theatrical, right?
Exactly.
Hey, I'm just now, you know, catching up on that. So are all of your plays available for theater groups to lease or to perform? Can people buy or rent the scripts for those, or how are you doing that?
Well, we have on our website, firsthandtheatrical.org, the two plays that I created from this woman in Skokie, Illinois' she and I created these plays together, and those are actually, we self-published those through the KDP site on Amazon. Mm-hmm. I haven't made yet available for purchase the other scripts, but they are absolutely available. If anyone were to ever be interested in producing them, that would be thrilling. I haven't yet done any real marketing to that effect, so maybe that's something that I can be working on over this summer, is to try to market the work we've done already a bit more.
Well, it's a good time because we're in a pandemic and we're supposed to be sheltering at home, so you have plenty of time.
Yeah.
So besides being on summer vacation, summer break from the college, and now you have a job, you're going to be marketing your other plays. Are you working on any other projects?
Well, I have been spending the last couple weeks exploring a possible theme for a play that focuses on, this sounds crazy, I've been reading Jill Lepore's fabulous long American history book called These Truths, and I've gotten up to the Civil War, and I was struck by the early 1800s, the pre-Civil War part of the 1800s, and the lives of women that she references, and I said, oh, that's interesting. I didn't know about this person or that person, and they have some really interesting things. So I'm actually exploring right now the possibility of continuing to research and find interesting stories of the lives of women in this particular era. So I'm looking at mill workers in New England. I'm looking at women in the South who oversaw slaves. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at abolitionists. I'm looking, there are some oral histories from people who were on the Trail of Tears, the removal of the Cherokees under Andrew Jackson, and even people out in New Mexico. There's a woman in New Mexico that I'm looking at, seeing if I can create a story, who ran a saloon, a house of prostitution, and a gambling parlor. So anyway, we'll see if that actually materializes into something. But right now I have a pile of about 15 books in my basement that I'm looking through.
Well, and I can throw in another woman for you from New Mexico. She's not really from New Mexico. She's a military wife, so she's not from anywhere. But she wrote an autobiography about being a military wife out here in the wilderness and being under attack and being in a cholera epidemic and being left with a gun while all the soldiers went off, and they left her in charge of payroll. And she talks about people dying out here. And it was in, I believe the book is called I Married a Soldier, but she would be a good part for you to think about too, because it gives a character that very few people have seen, the military spouse in the 1800s.
Beautiful. Why don't you offline send that to me, Cersei?
I will do so. I'm sorry, I don't remember who wrote it, but it's a good book.
I'll track it down if you give me the title.
Okay, good. So give us the name of how can people find out more about your touring schedule? I mean, when you guys open up again, or more about any of the plays? It was firsthandtheatrical.org, or do you have a Facebook, or...?
There is a Facebook page that's been ignored way too long, but probably firsthandtheatrical.org if people are interested. One of the links on there has a history and a brief description with some photos of the plays that we've produced, and that would be a great place to go. And there's email contact information on there if anyone's interested in getting a hold of me with any inquiries.
Okay, well, I'll put that on the bottom of the podcast. I'll put the link to your site on the bottom of the podcast when I get it uploaded later on. Well, I think we should probably wrap this up, and I wanted to thank you. But is there anything else you'd like our listeners to know about you that we haven't covered, or anything that you think interesting that we should know?
You know, just lastly, in my teaching, I teach both communication and theater courses. It's interesting how the two jobs, if you will, inform each other,
mm-hmm.
that I find in my teaching I'm referencing and learning from the research and the creative process that I'm involved with doing my plays. And when I'm writing my plays, I find myself referring back to my lessons in public speaking about how to structure storytelling in a speech. So that's been a really interesting discovery over the last 5 years.
Well, that is interesting, and communication majors out there should probably think about if they get tired of being in communications, they should move over to theater.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Well, Kevin, we need to wrap it up. Once again, this has been Circe Wessner, the director of the Museum of the American Military Family, and this is our podcast, At Ease. And I've been so happy to talk to my cousin Kevin. We haven't spoken for a while, and he's a playwright and director and communicator, professor. I mean, he's like a Renaissance man. And I wanted to thank you, Kevin, for talking with me today.
Thank you, Circe. Always a pleasure to chat with you.
All right. Well, you take care.